To order. They are still working, and we'll give them a few minutes. But we have a, you are good to go. Okay, sorry about the delay. We had a little bit of just a few little business items. You have in your packet a few resource items. If you want all the names and numbers of everyone that you need for our committee, you can either keep this in your file, in the save file, or back at your office. And in case you need to know who everybody is in the committee. So there are two that you can either put in your save file or in or take back to your office, either one. And Representative Earhart was not here for our first meeting, and so we just want to acknowledge one more at the last meeting. Everyone introduced themselves, so we'll give you a quick opportunity to join our group.
I'm here from representing Edina 49A.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we have a new page helping us this morning. Ryan Nash is here helping the committee, so thank you very much. And then if whoever was here for the Thursday, January 10th, would move the minutes. Representative Carlson moves the minutes of January 10th. Any changes or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Those meetings, the minutes are approved. And then the other one doesn't have a date, so we're just noting that whoever makes the motion will also move the date Tuesday, January 15th for the joint committee. Were you present at that one?
Yes, ma'am. Shall so move, including the date.
And so if you want to quickly check whether you're shown as attending, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Those minutes are approved. And the commissioner is not presenting today, but we invited him to come because I don't know if all of you have met him. He's the commissioner that we deal with in this particular committee, and so we'd like to welcome you to the committee and give you a few minutes to talk capital investment or other department issues.
Why, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Jim Showalter, Commissioner of Management and Budget. I appreciate the chance to come and introduce myself to the committee and give you a couple of thoughts and perspectives. I've been with the state for quite a few years, and this is an interesting committee and one that I've interacted with for a long time. In fact, not long before I started with the state, there was a significant effort about capital budget reform. And really, that is sort of what grounds a lot of the activities that MMB currently does. To help this committee get information about projects and balance the trade-offs between these capital investments. Because it's not so hard to pick construction projects or investments. What is hard is to think about the long-term impact of them, think about what you're trying to build, and make sure that you've got all the commitments lined up so that the bonds are supportable, they fit within the tax guidelines, that they meet the kinds of standards that the state wants to invest in, and ultimately you've got all the information about the long-term operating impacts. That's hard. And that's something that Kristen Hansen, the assistant commissioner who you'll be talking with, Sue Garola, and our budget division really help work with your staffs and each of you to assess and understand the trade-offs in all those projects. Kristen's going to be giving you a little bit of an overview about the debt guidelines, which is also something that's very close to my attention and something that we worked on extensively just a few years ago. Kathy Cardell, who you may know, she's currently with Hennepin County. Myself and Tom Hansen all worked extensively on trying to find a way for the state to move beyond about a 20 or 30 year set of guidelines that really led to a very specific view of debt to general fund and the debt service on general fund. And the markets have changed since 30 years ago quite extensively, and what we were starting to see were people were obligating the state for other kinds of things that weren't necessarily general obligation bonds. And so those guidelines were changed in consultation with the rating agencies, frankly, because they were very happy about the stability of our guidelines, but they also recognized that we may need to broaden the scope and broaden the width, and that's exactly what we did. We gave ourselves some room so that we had the ability to continue our bonding program and grow it, but it also made sure that we didn't get end run, so that this committee had a good idea and purview of all the kinds of obligations that might be coming from the state, whether they be appropriation bonds, revenue bonds, CLPs, all kinds of other different tools that are appropriate at times for different types of debt but are still obligations of the state. And that's what we try to get to with these bonding guidelines. And that stability and that measure is something that's been very important in our conversations with the rating agencies. I think it's a good, stable place to be. And it gives us certainly a chance to measure ourselves against other states in ways that are meaningful for us as well as the rating agencies. So on behalf of M&B, just appreciate the opportunity to talk with you. If you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them. But you're in very capable hands with Kristen Hansen and her staff. We were thrilled when we were able to recruit Kristen away from the private sector to come and join us. And I cannot overstate just the complexity and the challenges that she has faced in the last couple of years as we continue to take on different issues. And we work in a changing environment, both legally, in the tax laws, and the markets. Obviously, the financial markets have been kind of crazy, yet the state, I think, has been served extraordinarily well by our debt management program.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner referenced Tom Hansen, who coincidentally is in the audience today, so we revisit that past history. So we're going to get a lot of detail, as you can see from the handouts, but if you have broad questions of the commissioner, I am assuming that you're not staying for the
Correct. The
meeting, so that if you wanted to address anything to him before we go into the details that he suggested. But I see none, so thank you very much. It was good to have the opportunity.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
And we now have Kristen Hansen, Assistant Commissioner. Are you assisted by anyone else, or we're...
I'm going solo.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Kristen Hansen. I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Treasury at Minnesota Management and Budget. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. I'm going to talk about the state's capital investment guidelines as well as the recently released cancellation report. You should have some handouts that I did share with the committee. And there should be kind of a six-page per slide handout, but I've tried to make sure that there were bigger handouts so you could read some of the slides that had really little print.
But first, you want us to reference the PowerPoint.
Yes, right? Please reference the PowerPoint, and then I will draw your attention to the handouts that I am pulling the information from. Commissioner Showalter indicated some of the history regarding the capital investment guidelines. The state has had capital investment guidelines since 1979, and at that time there were actually five guidelines. And they have changed over time. Guideline one is the one that some of you are probably most familiar with, which was the policy that limited the appropriation for debt service from the general fund to pay state GOs to 3% of the non-dedicated general fund. There was also a guideline, too, where the principal amount of GO bond debt should not exceed 2.5% of the personal income of state residents, which we'll see kind of come forward with the new guidelines that were established in 2009. Guideline 3 had the total amount of all state agency debt outstanding at the end of fiscal year not to exceed 3.5% of state personal income. A lot of this debt, those agencies have their own authority to issue debt, so that was something the state did not have any control over at the time.
And members, excuse me, I think we'll ask questions along the way rather than, we'll
that's
take
fine.
Them and have them, so that means we might interrupt from time to time,
that's okay.
But I think that flow works better.
Guideline 4 was the total amount of all state kind of obligations, including GOs, but other, the moral obligation debt, equipment capital leases, and real estate leases. And guideline 5 is that 40-70 test that has remained the same since the beginning of the guidelines. In 2009, those guidelines were changed, as Commissioner Showalter indicated, to reflect more of the times. The original guidelines did not include all the debt that rating agencies do include in their calculations and made them more in line with what the rating agencies use to analyze state debt and compare states to other states. It's a more simple and straightforward and comparable to what other states are using.
Where did we get from guideline 3 to guideline 4 and 5?
I sort of missed that, too. So when you were giving the history early on in
1979,
you said there were five. But we don't see those.
No, I'm just talking off of them.
So
they're in my notes. But I would be happy to get those to you and share them with you.
And so she was giving past history, but currently, It's guidelines 1, 2, and 3, which I think we're coming to right now.
Yes. So I just gave you the history of what was in place in 1979 and that now, since 2009, we have changed those guidelines to conform more with what the rating agencies look at, as well as to easily compare us to other states and what they have for outstanding debt. And I think, as Ms. Dyson indicated at the hearing on Thursday, as you can imagine, states have various different constitutions and state laws that dictate what their debt is and describe their debt. So this kind of helps the rating agencies do comparables.
So on this slide, what I heard her say was guidelines 1 and 2 are the new ones. Guideline 3 is a continuation. We have always had that.
Exactly. So guideline 1, as established in 2009, is total tax-supported principal outstanding shall be 3.25% or less of state personal income. And as of the November 2012 forecast, and in your handouts you should actually have a copy of that forecast. It's a 6-page document that gives you more details about that. But as of November 2012 forecast, the total principal outstanding was $6.9 billion, which equals 2.74% of state personal income.
And so, members, that is the one that is dated December 5, and under the subject it says debt capacity report. And if you look at the back page, you'll see the total number that she references. That's the piece she's referencing right now.
Yes, and I will talk more specifically about that in the next slide as well.
Representative Carlson has a question.
Yeah. Could I ask a question? When that guideline is looked at, we have other entities that have bonding authority, for example, University of Minnesota. Is that calculated totally separately from these guidelines then?
Ms. Hanson.
Madam Chair, Representative, in regards to the University of Minnesota, the only debt that appears from the University of Minnesota in our guideline is the debt that's supported by the state general fund appropriation. And that can be seen on page 3 of the 6-page document. The other debt that the University of Minnesota issues is their own debt supported by their own revenues, and they have their own debt guidelines regarding that.
Thank you.
Guideline 2 indicates that the total amount of tax-supported principal, both issued as well as authorized and unissued, for state includes state GOs, state moral obligations, equipment capital leases, and real estate leases, shall not exceed 6% of total state personal income. So this was a new guideline that was reworked in 2009 to be more in line with what the rating agencies look at. And as of November 12th forecast, the total principal, both issued and authorized and unissued, was $11.6 billion, which equates to 4.62% of state personal income. And so you can see that it's less than that 6% guideline. And those guidelines aren't necessarily goals or targets. They're not to exceed numbers. And then the last guideline has to do with how fast or quickly we spend down our debt. And that is the guideline that has remained the same. Used to be the old guideline 5, as I talked about in the history, is 40% of the state GO bonds are to mature within 5 years and 70% within 10 years. The rating agencies do look at how fast issuers of municipal bonds do pay off their debt. And so the figures for June 30th of 2012 were 35.6% and 67.9%. And Andy Lee's going to be talking about this when he talks about the debt service, but when we issued the tobacco settlement revenue bonds in 2011, the proceeds of those bonds were used to pay off earlier maturities of the GO bonds, thus putting that figure below that 40%. And the rating agencies and all the rating calls we have with them have been made aware of that, so we talk about that every time we talk to them. And so next year, you know, we're looking at being much closer to that. And we do have the flexibility to structure debt to put more principal in the earlier years to get us closer to those guidelines. But these have always been very conservative guidelines, and the rating agencies do look favorably upon these.
And so, members, I'm going to repeat a couple of things. So Representative Carlson asked about the University of Minnesota one. Again, it's still we're still talking about that debt capacity report. And if you turn to page 3, at the bottom, in the last paragraph, the legislature has also authorized the sale of state appropriation bonds to finance the, this is the TCF Bank Stadium at the University of Minnesota, and the, I think the research buildings would be there too.
Biosciences.
Yeah, the biomedical science buildings are also included.
The biosciences facilities are also there. So that is further part of it. And then just to repeat, so the guidelines that she's measured, the guideline one, we should be at 3.25% or less, and we are at 2.74%. Guideline two, we should not exceed 6%, and we are at 4.62. I think those are the important numbers that need to kind of jump out at you. Please continue.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Representative Earhart.
Are all three of these applied to all of the debt here, or are they selectively applied?
Well, to answer you, or Madam Chair, Representative, in actually going to slide 4, I will talk about how that is calculated so you can see what components of the debt factor into the calculation.
And then slide 4 that you're going on to is the back page. So if it's easier for you to read this than up there, it's the back page of the debt capacity report that she's going to talk about now. We've worked through this, and the numbers are hard to understand, so we're sort of working carefully at these so that there's clarity at the end.
Yes. So guideline 1, which is the total amount of principal outstanding, and these are numbers based on the November forecast, so this is actual principal amount outstanding. This is the first column of numbers under tax-supported debt guideline 1. And you can see that all of the debt included in guideline 1, if you go down the left-hand column, includes all the state's general obligation debt. That includes our various purpose debt as well as the trunk highway bonds. It includes the certificates of participation, which were the financing used to finance the statewide accounting program, the SWIFT project, as well as the Department of Revenue Integrated Tax Program. It includes the BCA Bemidji lease revenue bonds. It includes other real estate capital leases. There were the St. Paul Port Authority actually issued lease revenue bonds to finance the Freeman Building and the Anderson Building. So this is the amount of principal outstanding on those two buildings, the $64 million and the $77 million. You see the Minnesota Housing Finance Authority Supportive Housing. They received legislative authority for a supportive housing program. And so they have $30,840,000 outstanding for that program that was appropriated a couple of years ago. You'll see the University of Minnesota projects, the TCF Bank Stadium, as well as the biomedical science facilities. You see the state general fund appropriation refunding bonds. These were the appropriation bonds that were issued in November to refinance the tobacco settlement revenue bonds. And that total of tax-supported debt is $6.9 billion. And you take that number divided by the fiscal year 2013 state personal income estimate from the GII forecast. That number is below the second shaded line under total obligations of about $251 billion. So essentially, to come up that with the percentage, you take that 6.9 principal outstanding divided by the state personal income to come up with the 2.74. So you can see all the components of debt that are included.
And then just to be clear about that word unissued, unissued does not mean that it hasn't been encumbered. So I think that might be a helpful clarification.
Correct. Right now we're just talking about principal outstanding. So when I talk about guideline 2, we'll get into the...
So you're going on to the second.
Yes, but...
Representative Mahoney.
And maybe this is a question that the witness will be answering later, but the bioscience facilities at the university, the $55 million, how long ago did we authorize those particular bonds? I thought it was more than 4 years.
Madam Chair, Representative, I will double check on when those were authorized. I'll get that statute, and I don't know
it off
the top of my head.
It has been more than 4 years, I can say. Yes. Really. And so my guess is the question is why, if they weren't expended yet, why weren't they canceled? Is that the intent of your question?
It might have. It was the setup for later. But thank you.
made aware.
And my guess is that because of the different way we authorized those, we gave the university 10 years as opposed to 4 years. Is what I I'm looking for. Deb Dyson. That was my understanding. It was a different kind of authorization.
Madam,
we authorized that for a 10-year period instead of Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Mahoney, the bioscience medical facilities, those are University of Minnesota bonds, and it's a general fund appropriation, and the statute that authorized it has a schedule for the amounts, maximum amounts each year for payment from the general fund to the University of Minnesota so they can pay debt service, but it's spelled out in the statute that authorized the facilities.
That's right. And we didn't authorize those, so we wouldn't have the right to cancel them. Ms. Hanson.
Madam Chair, the biomedical or the bioscience buildings were authorized in 2008.
2008?
Yes.
Continue?
Yes, and just alluding to kind of cancellation report, the cancellation report is general obligation bonds and general fund, you know, obligations. So it's, as Ms. Dyson indicated, it's a different kind of appropriation. So going to Guideline 2 includes issued bonds, so the total that I just talked about in Guideline 1, but it also includes bonds that are authorized and unissued. And so you can see that in addition to the 6.9, we also have about $2 billion of unissued GO bonds, and that is, like I said, trunk highway bonds and various purpose bonds, and over $1 billion of that is trunk highway, and just over $900 million is GO various purpose bonds. The Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, they have housing infrastructure bond authorization of $30 million that they have not issued yet. The biosciences facilities at the U have $55 million in remaining authorization. And you can see that in legislation that's been passed is that the professional football stadium appropriation bonds have been authorized, but they have not yet been issued. You can see the $348 million for the state share, as well as the $150 million of the City of Minneapolis' share. And then in 2011, there was also a program for pay-for-performance appropriation bonds in $10 million of authorization, which has not yet been issued. So that gets added to Guideline 1. As well as we have some moral obligation debt that's been issued by the Housing Finance Agency as well as the Office of Higher Education, which gets included, as well as equipment leases. That's our master lease program that we use. So the Guideline 2 takes all of our tax-supported debt that's been issued, adds on our authorized but unissued piece, and adds those three other types of debt to the calculation. So you see, in the second shaded line, total all obligations, $11.6 billion. That number is also divided by that state personal income estimate to come up with the 4.62%.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, on your slide with regard to the maturity of the general obligation bonds, you note a certain percentage is maturing in 5 years, a certain maturity is maturing in 10 years. Do you have any idea in terms of what the interest rate on those maturing bonds is, as an average?
Madam Chair, Representative, the interest rates on that outstanding debt are different. Every time we issue bonds, they're going to carry a different interest rate. Representative Houseman indicated that we got 2.05% on our bonds when we issued them. This fall, the year before that, it was at 2.82%.
Okay.
So it incorporates all the interest rates at the time of issuance.
Thank you.
Continue.
There is another, before I get into kind of some of the details of the guidelines, which I'll probably walk through quickly. I've also included a handout that shows the state of Minnesota state net tax-supported debt ratios and Moody's ratings, so you can see where the state is in the compared to other states. So it's a two-page handout.
But just to repeat again, it says state of Minnesota state net tax supported debt ratios and Moody's medians, and then there's also some information on that.
And there's also a page from what the most recent Moody's median debt median report, so you can see where the other states are for the most recent calculation. And so the middle column is the net tax supported debt as percent of personal income. This is our guideline one. When Moody's does this analysis, obviously they don't have as current information as we do, so the numbers are going to be slightly different, but you can actually see in 2012 that they're estimating our percent to be 2.7, and we're looking at 2.74, so it's not that dramatically different. But you can see where we've been since 2000. And you can see on the sheet, the Moody's sheet that shows table 2, the net tax-supported debt as a percent of 2011 personal income. So obviously we're using more updated personal income. You can see that we are 27th on the list, with Hawaii being the highest. And other states that you often hear about, California and Illinois, are 8 and 9.
I will take this opportunity. I think the pages have another sheet. This is I think you get this on a regular basis. This was just the most recent one I was able to find. This is the Tax Foundation's 2011 facts and figures. It's hard to get up to date. They also look at this, and they have two tables, state debt per capita from fiscal year 2009, and then state and local debt per capita from 2008. And of course, those rankings look at it from a different perspective, but state debt per capita, you will note we are ranked 43, but state and local, from the previous year, we're ranked 18. So that tells us we have less debt at the state level than they do at the local level, I think. So just another way of looking at that ranking of level. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you refinance debt when interest rates are acceptable?
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, yes, we do. And I will be talking about that later on in the presentation.
Thank you.
So just to be clear on what is included in our guidelines, you can see guideline one includes our GEO various purpose bonds, our GEO trunk highway bonds, and our state-issued state appropriation bonds. It does not include any of our revenue bonds that are outstanding because, as Ms. Dyson indicated last Thursday, those are supported by their own revenue stream and do not count against our guidelines. Other types of state obligations, the state standing appropriations, as we talked about, the University of Minnesota, as well as the Minnesota Housing Finance Authority, the lease purchase financing for equipment, that's the certificates of participation for the SWIFT project, and then the lease purchase financing for real estate, which I also mentioned, the Freeman and Anderson buildings, as well as the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension up in Bemidji. Then guideline two, issued, authorized, and unissued is all debt included in guideline one, plus the lease purchase financing for equipment, the state's master lease program, as well as the moral obligations that have been issued by the Housing Finance Agency and the Office of Higher Ed. And the next slides just highlight what is also on that page 6 of the debt capacity forecast. All of our GO debt outstanding is $5.7 billion. All of our appropriation debt, which includes both state and other appropriation debt issued by other entities, is $961. This is supported by state appropriations. Leases for real estate is $148 million, and the certificates of participation at the time of the forecast were $54 million. However, we actually defeased a portion of those, so that number is now less. For guideline two, the equipment leases as of the November forecast were $19.9 million outstanding, and you can see the moral obs as well. Just under $1.5 billion for the Housing Finance Agency. They do not issue moral obs anymore, so those numbers are going down, and the Minnesota Office of Higher Ed is $612 million. So some of the other things related to debt that were not covered last week are some of the debt policies and informal practices that we have to consider from a debt management side. We currently have post-issuance compliance policies and procedures. What has happened is that the IRS has increased its audit of municipal debt issuers. They have increased questionnaires. They've increased the amount of auditing staff. They have actually assigned, all the states have an assigned person that I can talk to if I have any questions. But when questions come out from the IRS regarding any questionnaires about certain types of debt issues, one of the first questions they ask is, does the state have post-issuance compliance policies and procedures? And yes, we do. That talks about how we keep, you know, monitor bond expenditures to make sure that we keep the bonds tax exempt. It talks about, you know, educating, you know, staff and things like that. So this has really kind of become very important. The IRS is actually looking at this because they want to make sure issuers of tax-exempt debt are not abusing that tax-exempt status. And so this is their way of capturing any abuses and getting money back to the federal government. There was also the question about refundings. We do always monitor the opportunity to refund bonds, and there will be a slide indicating that we're currently looking at that now. But we do have refunding criteria. We actually want to make sure that we have savings on of at least 3% by maturity and 5% total for the total par amount of the bonds. And so right now we are actually looking at what bonds we can refinance and that meet those thresholds. And as you can imagine, with this very favorable interest rate environment from issuers of tax-exempt bonds, not necessarily investors, we're looking at that. One of the factors we do have to consider is when we do refund bonds, that money gets put into an escrow, and those interest rates are really low, too. And so that affects the savings and results in what's called negative arbitrage. So I do not want to get into the minutiae of negative arbitrage. But there's a lot of pieces that go into consideration with the refunding, but we are looking at that seriously right now. Currently, we have the ability to do both competitive and negotiated sales. As Representative Hausman indicated, most of our sales are competitive, and she invited you to all come watch a competitive sale where we, you know, take bids on the bonds. But should there be a time in the market where it's difficult to access the market, in 2008 when the markets kind of crashed, it was very difficult. Interest rates went up. Banks didn't have a lot of capital that they were willing to invest. Investors didn't have any cash. So at that time, you know, the ability to negotiate sales if, you know, and you needed to bring something to market, you know, allows us that flexibility in timing when the market might not be there for you. We also use an independent public financial advisor to help us with our transactions. In my past life, that's what I actually used to be. In the private sector and consulted with school districts, but those are hired through an RFP process, and so we have a financial advisor that works with us on our GO bonds. For those of you that have attended the sales, you may have met Tom Hustis from Prague. For our non-GO sales, we use PFM. And then timing of bond sales is significant because of there's a lot of things that are happening at the legislature as well as with the release of the forecast and other things. And so we have to be careful that we're not selling at times when there's significant information coming out to the market that could affect the sale of the bonds. So we look carefully at that when we time.
And that is because we get a rating for every bond sale. I mean, you see that we have a rating over time, but they also rate us before every bond sale. So that would be in reference to her careful timing of that.
Madam Chair, that was excellent transition to my next slide. As Chairman Hausman said, is that, yes, every time we go to market, we get a bond rating on the bonds, no matter what kind of bonds they are. Bonds may be rated by one or more of the three major credit rating agencies, Fitch Ratings, Moody's Investor Service, and Standard & Poor's. A bond rating is a measure of credit risk to the investors. So AAA is the highest rating. D, bonds are in default. And essentially, the higher the credit rating, the lower the risk to the bondholders, as well as the lower the interest rate.
Madam Chair.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you. Do you have any idea what the cost of the state has been since we lost our AAA?
Ms. Hanson.
I actually do, Madam Chair, Representative Earhart. After the two rating agencies in 2011, Fitch and S&P downgraded the state from a AAA to a AA+. Moody's had done that already in 2003. We really looked at what that interest rate cost would be, and it was about 5 basis points or 0.05%. We did talk. So there was a cost to that.
Not in dollars, though, I'm asking.
No, I haven't done that calculation in dollars, but I can see if we can get that calculation for you.
0.05%
in interest, in the actual interest rate.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, from time to time we issue bonds and then we set up a separate revenue stream to pay those off. And now when you reference going to market, what might typically happen if they view that revenue stream as inadequate, at least under current law? Not to mention any projects, but there is one that's been publicized quite a bit lately that isn't quite meeting expectations.
Madam Chair, Representative, those bonds are general fund appropriation bonds, and so they do not have a revenue bond coverage requirement.
Follow-up?
Well, I would expand on that a little bit for me.
Ms. Hanson.
A revenue bond, but still there would be interest rate impact on that, correct, if there's some question about the revenue stream? Would they not be more expensive if there's some question about the revenue stream?
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, the way that the legislation was drafted, that the bonds that would be issued would be considered general fund appropriation bonds, and there was actually in the legislation no tie to that exact revenue stream. And so when appropriation bonds are issued by the state, when we recently did that for the state general fund appropriation refunding bonds, the credit ratings on those bonds were just a notch below the AAA, so we had a AA rating from S&P and a AA rating from Fitch, which will be on my next slide, for those state-issued appropriation bonds. So it'll be lower than a GO, but they're not a traditional revenue bond like the 911 revenue bonds or the pension building revenue bonds, which have a dedicated pledged revenue stream and required, which requires coverage, specific coverage requirements.
Any more follow-up?
Not at this point. Thank you.
Please continue.
This slide does show what the existing state of Minnesota bond ratings are. You can see for the general obligation bonds, which most of you are somewhat familiar with, especially after we got downgraded last year, Fitch, we have a AA plus from Fitch, Moody's a AA1. They use a different numbering categories than Fitch and S&P, and S&P also has us at a AA plus. Our state appropriation bonds, as I indicated, Fitch has a AA and S&P has a AA. We did not get the Moody's rating because when we originally sold the tobacco settlement revenue bonds, we only used the two rating agencies, and since these bonds were to refinance those, we used the same rating agencies. And then the 911 revenue bonds have a Fitch AA, a Moody's AA3, and an S&P AA+, and we actually recently, this fall, went to market to refund the pension building bonds. Those were all AAA, and because they had very high coverage. Some other things that we do have to consider when we're issuing bonds is tax exemption. Most of our GO bonds are issued as tax exempt, and as I indicated, the IRS really is starting to audit and monitor that. And when you're discussing bond projects, if there is any kind of private use in there, you know, we have to be really careful about private use, because depending on meeting certain IRS regulations, that could make the bonds taxable. And so given some of the unique projects coming forward that have, you know, private, you know, entities supporting it, these become very lengthy discussions with tax counsel. Obviously, we want to make sure we can issue bonds at the lowest interest rate, which is the tax-exempt rate. But there are going to be circumstances as the projects become more complicated that they may become, some of the bonds may have to be issued as taxable. Arbitrage is another IRS regulation that we have to follow. When they changed the tax law in 1986, the federal tax law, before that, issuers of municipal bonds would issue tax-exempt bonds, and then they would refinance them, you know, over and over again to kind of benefit from the tax-exempt rates and to save money and kind of abuse the tax-exempt status. So changes in the federal tax law in 1986 really kind of put in place regulations to limit the abuse of issuing tax-exempt bonds. And so we need to make sure that we're not earning more money than what the interest rates are on the bonds. Otherwise, we'll have to rebate it to the federal government. So there's things that we have to keep track of on our end with the interest rate market. There's also disclosure requirements. The Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, back in 1995 in July, added some additional disclosure requirements for issuers of tax-exempt debt. What's important about this is prior to that rule change, the Orange County fiasco, the people that held the Orange County bonds did not have any information about the kind of financial situation of the issuer except for the original offering document. These new disclosure requirements require issuers to file annual disclosures with the SEC so bondholders can be kept apprised of what is happening with the issue. There's also voluntary disclosures. There's also kind of mandatory disclosures from material event notices. So we have to keep track of that on our end. And then there's, as I indicated, the new enforcement by the IRS. So there's things that we have to consider to make sure that we're in compliance with not only state law and the state constitution, but federal rules and regulations. Some of the debt issuance plans that we're looking at in 2013 is that we're looking at refinancing the St. Paul Port Authority bonds, the ones that were used to finance the Anderson and Freeman buildings. We're also monitoring the ability to refund some of our state GO bonds to save debt service. The stadium appropriation bonds, we're looking at perhaps issuing all or some in the spring of 2013. The pay-for-performance bonds, the $10 million that I had mentioned earlier, we're looking at a spring of 2013 sale so long as everything is in line for that pay-for-performance program. We traditionally do our state GO bond sale after the end of session, so that usually takes place in July or August, and that is the sale that you are more than welcome to attend. The University of Minnesota does have $55 million in remaining authorization for their bioscience program, and they usually, since it is supported by a state appropriation, they wait for us to sell our GO bond so that they can use the updated information we've disclosed in our official statement so they can disclose it in their official statement. And then the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, they have a new authorization, and they're looking at issuing theirs later in 2013. So it could be a busy year for us in debt management. At this point, are there any questions about kind of the guidelines and other debt management issues that I deal with on a daily basis?
Because we're moving on then to the cancellation report. So I think people have been asking questions as they, any more before we move on to cancellation report? Representative Svitzinski?
Madam Chair, one question was, we looked at that kind of percentage of payback where we, within 5 years, we usually try to pay up to 40%, within 10 years, 70%. If we were to move those percentages up, would that be of benefit when it comes to rating or percentage of bond sale? Or, I mean, if we would speed that up at all, could we influence some of that bidding process in a positive way?
Madam Chair, Representative, in regards to Guideline 3, which is the how fast we pay off our debt, the 40%, 70%, right now we have very conservative guidelines already. And so the rating agencies look at a myriad of factors when they're looking at it. So we already have a very conservative thing as a conservative guidelines that we're already abiding by. Representative Hausman indicated last week that, you know, the rating agencies look at our financial management, they look at, you know, policy decisions, they look at our state economy. And so that is not going to carry as much weight as some of the other things do in when the rating agencies evaluate our bond ratings.
Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question on some of these unused, unissued bonds. They can only be used for that bonding purposes. Say if the university had another project, you can't transfer that into any other projects. Am I correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, you are correct. The law prescribes what you can use those bond authorizations for, and you cannot deviate from that.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Did you want to follow up?
Excuse me.
Okay. Representative Earhart.
Thank you. I don't know the difference between a general obligation and a state appropriation bond. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me what the difference is?
Madam Chair, Representative.
Ms. Hanson.
A general obligation bond, whether it's state-issued or issued by another governmental entity, has the full faith and credit taxing power behind the payment of those bonds. And so should we not have the funds to make payment on the bonds, we do have the authority in statute to, the state auditor has the authority to levy all the taxpayers in the state to make that bond payment. It's a very strong commitment to the bondholders that you will make the bond payments. GO bonds are the most secure bonds that you can issue. An appropriation bond is just that, it's an appropriation. And so there can be a case of a non-appropriation where that payment is not made. You don't have that general obligation backing, that guarantee that those bonds, you know, a revenue source will be made available to make those debt payments. That's why the ratings are lower than those of the GO bonds.
What is the backing then, Madam Chair and presenter, for the appropriation bonds? What security is there for those?
Madam Chair, Representative, in the financial market, how the bondholders view these bonds is that the issuer of the bond is going to make that appropriation, but they also know that there is that risk that non-appropriation would be made.
So, in other words, his question was, what security is there? There really isn't. The assumption is that no future legislature will renege. I mean, that and that's why they're not as secure as GO bonds, which are backed by the full faith and credit of the state.
Madam Chair, you are correct.
Thank you.
Okay.
Switching gears to the cancellation report, it is a statutory requirement. Minnesota chat.
And that one is dated January 2, and it's a cover letter, and then she's going to discuss the details of that report.
So what the statute says that on January 2nd of each odd-numbered year, MMB must report the cancellation of general fund and bond finance property authorizations more than 4 years prior to January 1st. So this will refer to any bond authorizations that were made in 2008 and earlier. And so there are a couple of spreadsheets with really little print.
And I will tell you, members, that sometimes somebody out in your community sees their project here and is somewhat startled because they haven't been aware that about this, either the timeline or that they were so close to the end of that timeline. And you will sometimes hear from them. And we have on occasion, if they can come here and convince us there's a reason, we can, in fact, in the next bill, because these cancel on July 1st, we can, in fact, reauthorize. And sometimes we change that date. Ms. Hanson.
Madam Chair. Yes, bullet 3 says that the project balances that are included in this report are canceled effective July 1st unless they are specifically reauthorized by the legislature. So this list with the really little font that I have trouble reading with my progressive lenses shows that if you turn to the last page, or I can highlight this, is that what you want to look at is the far right column that says uncommitted. This means that that money is unencumbered. It means that it's not under contract. There's no legal contract to say that those funds are going to be used to pay toward that project. So the unencumbered or non-contracted amount that show up on the cancellation report, which is projects 2008 and prior, or authorizations, is $18 million. $2.5 million of that is GeoTrunk highway bonds, and about $15.5 million is in general fund supported bonds. When we did release this report, there are some of the agencies have kind of sub-programs that don't feed into our program for generating this report. So since this report was released, we have found out that there are actually contracted encumbered funds that are listed in this $18 million that will be removed, and we will be updating that report. So there are legal contracts for those payments of about $500,000.
Rip that board.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Hansen, can you tell us or share for me anyhow, would any of these projects have been completed and there was the bid came in lower, the project was lower, so it's money that's being carried over, but the project was completed rather than it was totally not done?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that could be the case.
Follow-up? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Hansen. One of the things that members have the most questions about and confusion about is just kind of the general process of where we pass a bill. Let's say we pass a bill with $1 million for a building X. I think in members' minds, they think that then there is $1 million immediately available to start spending on that. And when the construction is done, whatever's left over is not. But there's actually a bond sale, a transfer, and then the drawdowns on that. Can you just, like, in one little tiny paragraph, just kind of explain that? Because we got a lot of freshmen that just kind of, when we're looking at the cancellations, and I have a question just about that. But if you just maybe explain just that three-step process, just because that's kind of foggy for a lot of people, particularly for freshmen coming in.
Madam Chair, Representative, I might be longer than a little paragraph. That's a very good question. Most members come from communities where their local governments issue municipal bonds. If it's a school district that passes a bond issue, what happens is those bonds get issued right away for the project. That does not happen here at the state. We do not issue bonds until we have gone through all of the appropriate steps to release those monies. And so the bonding bill gets passed, and there's an authorization for, you know, a project. Oftentimes these projects require a local match, so we at MMB actually have to make sure that they make that local match requirement. We look for documentation. There's a grant agreement that needs to be signed before we can release any of the money. And as you know, some projects take longer than others, and so we only issue bonds as the cash flow for the projects is needed. So it's a little bit different than what you see in your local communities.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Hansen, so when we pass the bill, the bonds are sold when it's a good time to do so, it's appropriated, and then the project is, there's draws over a long period of time on that. And I think when a lot of members are looking at either cancellation reports or what's left, there's questions of, we gave you this money 5 years ago, why is it not spent yet? That's a major question. A lot of times that has to do with the fact that there isn't a local match, or that the money didn't materialize. That's probably one of the frustration pieces of that. So can you talk just a little bit about why sometimes projects wind up on that sheet because we don't have a local match? And then can you just explain what unencumbered means?
Ms. Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll answer the unencumbered first. That means that it's not legally under contract. There's no legal contract for that project. So if it's unencumbered, there is no legal contract with, you know, contractors to work on it. There's no legal requirement to make that payment. So if it's unencumbered, you know, we wouldn't be breaking any contracts by, you know, canceling those projects. In regards to kind of the specifics of why the projects don't happen, I would have to do more research on your behalf and get that information to you on, you know, because it's going to be unique from project to project.
So, in other words, if somebody sees their project here in that last column and comes to you and says, in fact, we already have a contract that is committed, then...
Madam Chair, that contract would need to have been in place prior to January 1st of 2013.
Right. But if it were, then that would be removed from the cancellation report, I think, right?
If it, in that case, because the legal contract was entered into prior to January 1st and we just were not made aware of it, I've had legal discussions, and that would have to be the case.
Representative House, when I came in as a freshman, I didn't understand how that worked. And I asked Representative Knobloch if he could explain it to me. And he said, why don't you stop up to my office and give yourself about 90 minutes? I'm sure it wouldn't take the average freshman that long to explain it to, but it took him 90 minutes. He figured it would take him 90 minutes to try to explain it to me. So, I mean, so it is complicated when you're first jumping in. And
well, I did hear Ms. Hansen say she was going to take longer than a paragraph. Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just you know, a simple example of why money isn't spent. Let's say that, you know, we... pass a bond to purchase land for a project, and then there isn't a willing seller of the land. So, you know, when the time is up, then, you know, the money, the bond can be canceled. I've run into that.
Is that that part? Or, Madam Chair, I shouldn't.
Don't say it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What is the amount, the current amount, maybe it's on here and I can't find it, of uncanceled, or I mean that could be canceled or whatever?
Ms. Hansen, do we have a total at the end?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's on the sheet with that says bond proceeds cancellation report January 2nd. It's on the last page, the far right bottom column, $18,374,000.
Well, as long as you told me, because I can't read it.
See, I can't. That's why I'm telling you out loud, because it's really small
okay.
Funds.
Now, Madam Chair and Ms. Hansen, does that then, if those are all canceled, does that rearrange the formulas then for how much is available for future? It changes your numbers again.
Ms. Hansen.
Madam Chair, Representative Earhart, the cancellations would not go into effect until July 1st unless there's action taken on by the legislature to reinstate them. We do have another forecast coming out, you know, the February forecast. We will update the debt capacity forecast, but at that time, those numbers would not reflect that because we will not know what kind of action the legislature is going to take. If after July 1st, when we do the November 2013 debt capacity forecast, that would show up in the guideline 2 authorized but unissued. That number would get reduced by whatever the cancellation amount is.
But we do normally think that when we cancel, we have added a little bit to our debt capacity.
Mm. Madam Chair, yes. A little bit compared to our outstanding.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the witness, I'm looking on page 4. Is that where the $18 million is supposed to be?
Yes.
You got a different sheet than I do. And what it's saying here is $17,743,000, and you keep talking about $18 million. Are you just rounding up? Because I get the rounding up part. It's like my checkbook.
Madam Chair, Representative, that number has been updated because there was some, you know, incorrect accounting for in the spreadsheet.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Ward.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was my question as well. Could you give us that number one more time, please? Because I, like Representative Dean, I have to have it a couple more minutes here. So,
89 minutes?
You got 90.
Madam Chair, Representative, 18,374,000. And these numbers will be updated on the MMB website. I have included that in the PowerPoint. And it will also reflect those encumbered projects that were encumbered prior to January 1st that we found out about that were not in the statewide accounting system.
And the first time I saw a cancellation report, you know how we normally add three zeros? I had to remind myself, in the case of the cancellation report, we don't.
No.
These are actual
numbers.
Little detail, because by that time they're balancing out and 10 cents has to be canceled, too. Groups award, yep. Any further?
Thank you.
Continue.
Madam Chair, there is also a one-page smaller cancellation report, which is general fund capital projects cancellation report for projects that actually received a general fund appropriation prior to, you know, in 2008 and earlier. That cancellation amount is $487,000, which you probably can't see on the little print. And then there's another attachment. There is another required report that was included with the cancellation report. It's the report on expenditures of bond proceeds. And that shows kind of all of the outstanding projects that have been expended, unexpended, and unencumbered as well. But that's not the cancellation report. But that is also included in your packet as well. So I just wanted to make sure that there's two separate. There's the cancellation report that includes the bonding and the general fund appropriation, and then there's the report on expenditures of bond proceeds.
Okay. Continue.
I believe I'm finished.
Oh, okay. So is this one yours? This other one? So any further questions for Ms. Hansen? It doesn't mean you understand it all, but at least you have the information before you. We have one additional bit of, you know, they're all, oh, Representative Mahoney.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I'm going to ask Chair or the presenter. I was going through the cancellation reports, and Department of Economic Deed has six or seven of them in there. And I'm wondering if there's some recommendations from the chair or from the presenter who would best, because if you have Crookston or Bioscience or Austin, some of the, who am I supposed to call to say, you know, what's this full story here and why? You, the department, the chair.
Does he call Deed or you?
Madam Chair, you can call our office and we can put you in touch with the appropriate person.
Thank you.
And for those of you who have an interest in a particular department, I would think that would be because you would have the opportunity in this bill this year to, if you wanted to extend some of that.
Can I just redirect?
Pardon me? Oh, redirect. okay, and you know, there are lots of ways to look at numbers, and so we have one other presentation. That is our fiscal analyst, Andrew Lee, House Fiscal Analyst, who is going to take one more look at this. There are a number of different approaches as you look at the figures, and we thought this would be helpful as well. Welcome to the committee. I think is this your first presentation?
It is, Madam Chair. Thank you, members. I'm reading off of the sheet that says Minnesota House Capital Investment General Fund Account.
So this is the last piece in your file. Again, it's just a one-pager. That's the one he's going to look at.
Madam Chair and members, this sheet is an attempt to kind of break down capital or debt service costs, capital projects, and kind of spell out what the total number for this committee will be when targets come out, and that's the bottom line 19 where it says total capital investment committee account. There's a lot of different projects and categories, and so this is kind of an attempt to get at that. You'll notice that on line 6, net debt service without capital projects and grants, that in the current biennium that we're in, 12 and 13, compared to 14 and 15, that number jumps quite a bit, and then grows at a slightly more gradual rate in 16 and 17. This spreadsheet tries to explain that the reason that that growth is so dramatic between this biennium and the biennium that we're going to be budgeting for is because of the tobacco bond proceeds, which you can see on line 2. In fiscal year 12, it paid down debt service on general obligation debt from $326 million, and in the biennium, $635 million. So that brought the number down kind of artificially low. So that's an explanation for that.
So we're more often interested in GO, and this dramatic change is not a result of GO debt, but the tobacco securitization.
I'm sure that's correct, yes. And just some other things to note here. You can see in fiscal year, or in the upcoming biennium, 14 and 15, the Viking Stadium debt service comes online. And also, if you look down on capital projects and grants, this is the breakout of the various, the U of M standing appropriations. You'll notice that on line 13, state appropriation refinancing bonds, that is the mechanism that the state is repaying the tobacco bonds. So you can see that's about $114 million a biennium in this upcoming biennium and the next one.
And members who are new, that was the method by which we balanced a budget 1 year, the tobacco securitization bonds, and now we're paying for balancing the budget that 1 year.
That's correct. Okay. One other note I should say, grants to St. Paul and payments to Minneapolis, that is a component of the Viking Stadium deal from 2012. So with that, I'd open up to any questions.
Okay. Just another look at, in this case, debt service costs and the breakdown. Questions for Mr. Lee? I think it must have been clear.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Madam Chair, I do have one, being that he referenced a couple of times the Vikings stadium, and it's my understanding, Madam Chair, that, you know, I was referencing that shortfall earlier, but the first $50 million has to be paid for by the Vikings. And how does that interact with the debt service then when that comes about? Because basically the money is appropriated, from my earlier question as I understand it, out of the general fund. There wasn't a direct tie to the gambling revenue. One of my concerns was, you know, once they break ground, and of course that's the next biennium, if the shortfall is still there, how that would be funded. But the Vikings pay the first 50. So do they just make a payment to the general fund, or do that, just how does that work? Or maybe you're not the right one, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Carlson, I believe that this figure only reflects the state's obligation towards the state's 300 and some million for that project.
So the question will, maybe somebody will just research that. His question is that going to be to the state? How does that get reflected on any spreadsheet? And that you may not have that information now, but might be a follow-up.
Madam Chair, Representative, the first $50 million that's coming from the Vikings, we will double-check that, but I suspect that that money will get paid to the Sports Facilities Authority to make the first payments toward the project. So it will not be passing through, the Vikings share will not be passing through this.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, that becomes important because if the shortfall continues, and apparently it's because the licensing and so on is taking longer than what they expected, that first $50 million might become quite important in terms of the groundbreaking next fall.
And I'm sure we'll get verification on that flow of funds of the Vikings' first $50 million.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further questions for either of the testifiers? I think we have answered all the questions. And you'll note at our next meeting, we are going to hear from University of Minnesota and Minsky, and then Deb Dyson will give us a little bit of further education on a deeper overview. So that's our. Oh, that's not Deb Dyson. A different researcher. Yeah. Further questions? Meeting is adjourned.